Friday, February 8th, I worked at my desk and with Ashton, and the first event of the day was to go to the Congressional Club, where the Texas delegation was having its monthly meeting, this one with a memorial service from Earl Patman, who died last summer. They're putting her name on a plaque in the Congressional Club, to which she was such a loyal member. This meeting of the Texas ladies used to be the big social event of the month for me in the 12 years when Lyndon was in the House, and still, though decreasingly, in the 12 years when he was in the Senate. At that time, the Senate dining room became my beat to take constituents for lunch. We were a close-knit group, the Senate ladies. We relished our companionship. If there were any little feuds, I didn't know it. And it was always a very pleasantly anticipated thing by both hostess and guest to take Texas constituents to the monthly luncheon at the Shoreham or the Kennedy Warren, or sometimes at the Congressional Club. I meant today to stay only for the sherry hour and the program. Opal Yarbrough, who is wife of the senior senator, is sort of the presiding officer, met me at the door and took me in. The familiar faces, as Linda would say, the honchos, were there. Ruth Burleson, J.D. Dowdy, Beryl Pickle. About 9 members' wives, I counted. A goodly number of the former members, because they don't go home again to Pocatello. At least many settle in Washington. I shall return to Texas, Lyndon and all of us. But I'll always come back on a cane as an old, old lady, because I love it here, too. And there were, as always, guests. I was introduced around the room, had a glass of tomato juice, and then, to my surprise, there was Wright. I did not know he was going to attend. We went into the room, where there are small statuettes of the first ladies wearing their inaugural gowns, down to and including me. And then Ruth Burleson delivered the loveliest memorial to Merle Patman. And Wright responded. Suddenly, in the middle of it, he quite broke up. Tears came to his eyes and his voice cracked, and he continued talking quite simply and movingly, with the tears rolling down his cheeks. There wasn't a woman there, I believe, who didn't feel closer to him for it. And I'm very glad that someone arranged this tribute, said goodbye all around, and was back in the car at 1:10, quickly to the White House, where I had lunch on a tray. I'm always ravenous by lunchtime these days, with nothing but coffee and juice for breakfast. And then saw Liz, and heard the last round, I hope, of what without a doubt is the most ridiculous little international bit I've been concerned with. We had deliberately tried to get for the entertainment something pleasant, reliable and low-key. The grave situation in the world today, it is not a time for dancing, and in a way not even for the glitter and display of musical comedy or ballet. So we decided on our dear, reliable, and so obliging Robert Merrill of the Metropolitan Opera. Well, he'd chosen his own songs, and they were On the Road to Mandalay and From Porgy and Bess, I Got Plenty of Nuttin'. The press had howled. Even Mort Rostow had winced, I'm told. Should we change the program? It was all so ridiculous. The Prime Minister read the program in the paper and sent word they were his favorites and he hoped we would keep them. And so at rest, I talked to Margie McNamara about the guest list for the party we hoped to give for them in late February. She's still in the hospital. She looks so painfully thin and drawn when I've seen her. Bob says, Margie gets my ulcers. When I look at them, I feel it is the right decision all around, that he will be getting out the 1st of March. Margie says she will return from the hospital tomorrow. In the afternoon, I went to Dr. Turchin's and then back at the White House tried to take a nap, but instead took to bed stacks of read and file, things to decide on, and a list of telephone calls. Among them, a long and interesting one to Lucy. I asked her to reminisce about the 16 days from the time Lyndon was sworn in until we moved in the White House. How did it look through the eyes of a 16-year-old? She should be a writer. She speaks so graphically. I am trying to brief myself to get ready to steep my mind and my feelings in the 2 periods that Howard K. Smith wants to discuss with me for his book. The weeks right after Lyndon became president, in late July of 65, about the time the decision was made to go into Vietnam with more ground troops. I called our house guests and welcomed them, the Joe Kilgores and the Sherman Birdwoods, and later the John Lyles. The Chief King gave me a brief rub, and then it was time to dress for the evening in the champagne satin that Adele Simpson had made to go under the beautiful gold coat that was a gift from a chief of state. John Louis piled my hair up on top of my head, and I was ready by 7:30 so that I could have a few pictures made. I'm hoping that if I do this just before every state dinner in an evening dress, someone will come out good that I can use as a standard picture to give away.
Oh,
and I tried once more to get a good picture in front of the painting that C.R. Smith had given the White House, the one of the Great Tetons. I like for the donors to keep on knowing by some reference, some gesture of appreciation, that their gift of 4, 3, 2 years ago is still giving pleasure and appreciated. Got the word that Lyndon would be late. I always have a case of hostess tenseness a few minutes before a party. Dean and Virginia and the first arrivals went into the yellow room. I began to have a drink with them, and then was summoned to go down with Lyndon at about 8:20 to meet the Prime Minister and Mrs. Wilson at the North Portico. There, too, was Lady Dean, and I made my apologies to her, because I don't know what happened at lunch at the British Embassy today. No doubt they were giving something for the Prime Minister, and Lyndon, who had had a talk with him supposed to last from 11:30 to 1, had simply abducted him and brought him and the total party, about 14, over to lunch on our second floor. I have no idea how many minutes' notice he had given Zephyr. Lyndon had simply knocked on my door a few minutes past 1 and said, "Come out and meet one of your favorite Prime Ministers." And there they all were, talking and working until past 3:30. Linda and Chuck joined us in the yellow room, and because we were already late, there was a brief drink and an exchange of gifts. A vermeil tobacco box, the Prime Minister's pipe that's ever present, a lovely vermeil tea caddy for Mrs. Wilson to go with the tea set we'd given her last June, another family picture, but now it's grown to 7, and they gave us 2 prints. One a Hogarth that Linda Bird loved, and 2 beautiful books, one on English gardens, and another on great English interiors. Oh. I had opened my beautiful Liber Amicitiae, the page on Great Britain, and had asked Best to make sure that he signed there my very first signature in this wonderful personal possession that I shall take away from the White House. And then we were downstairs and in line to meet the guests that had grown to 150. For the last 3 or 4 days, Bess and I had practically been praying for a snowstorm or a flu epidemic. The usual percentage of regrets had not come in. The law of averages says the number we'd invited would be brought down to or below 140. It didn't happen. There we were, straight up with 150, and only 2 staff members invited that we could afford to ask to eat in the mess, as we have done in a pinch before. John saved the day by figuring out a way to squeeze in 1 extra table, although it was a little too crowded to be gracious. And when Lyndon asked me at 6 o'clock, having just been told that Winston Churchill was in town, if we couldn't possibly make a place to invite him, and I had to say no. And it was about an hour later when a couple called saying they were down with the flu, and Bess miraculously got hold of him. And he came, very pink-faced and young, but with that magical name, a celebrity of the evening. From the cabinet, the Fowlers were there, and Bob, without Margie, still in the hospital. And from the Senate, the Henry Jacksons and Wallace Bennetts, Mike and Maureen, and both, yes, actually both, of the Javits. And the Bill Fulbright. Bill, polite and urbane. And Betty, with her hair drawn back very tight and high and looking quite distinguished. There was 1 governor, Godwin of Virginia. Quite a number of congressmen. Barefoot takes care of his own. And the Bill McChesney Martins, because money is very much a subject of the day. From business, there were the Bob Benjamins, cherubic and smiling as always. Mike Hyders, he's chairman of Standard Oil and has quite considerable interest in England, we're told. The Stuart Saunders of Pennsylvania Railroad, and the Tex Thorntons of Litton Industries. Some redoubtable veterans in public service, the John McCloys, the George Balls, former Senator Paul Douglas, and Mrs. Douglas, both of whom I like so much. We'd invited the Tom Fletchers, number 2 man in District of Columbia government, a flamboyant character like the mayor, to whom publicity comes so naturally. There is the makings of a rift there, and I do not want to see it happen. From labor, the Joseph Burns, and others I didn't know well, the John Loebs, whom I would like to classify under the title of old friends, and Norman Winston. From the press, Kay Graham, Imagine my amazement when she went down the line among the last, and the Prime Minister turned to me the next moment and said, "We are suing her newspaper for $40,000 for libel." And the Carl Ruins, to my surprise, Herb Block, and to my pleasure, pixie-looking Bill Mauldin and his wife. We talked of his mother-in-law in Santa Fe and how much I'd hated to miss the party that she and Tony had given together, the barbecue, and of how I'd simply adored to get off the Cuernavaca to the house they were renting for this month. And just as they went on down the line, they said, "We're going," leaving me wondering whether to Santa Fe or Cuernavaca. And our old friend Max Friedman, who disappeared from the Washington scene for several years, he said, "You know, I've been sick," and indeed he looked it, and added that for some months he'd been putting together a book on the correspondence between Justice Frankfurter and FDR. I had read it, in part, and it was a real service. He is now starting, he told me, on a biography of Justice Frankfurter. Beside our three house guests, there were a few other Texans, the Cecil Haydens from Houston, Judge Alfred Hernandez, a former president of the LULACs, the Bob Strausses from Dallas, from the entertainment world, Jim Backus, and two of the couples who it seemed to me were adding most to the party, by animated conversation, creating an aura of interest, Dr. and Mrs. Whitney Young, and our own Linda and Chuck. To be a good guest is an art. First, you act like you're having a good time, and then you try to spread it around. We squeezed our way into the crowded state dining room. The Prime Minister was on my right, with Trudy next, and then Dean, and then attractive Mrs. Stuart Saunders, whom I like so much, and William Jennings Bryan Dorn, Mrs. Fletcher and Scoop Jackson, Mrs. Bob Strauss, and Sir Patrick. They were a very interesting twosome to sit between. Some snatches of the conversation. The Prime Minister told me that he loved being on TV. Okay. And conversely, that he did not like making a public speech. I gather that means like on the courthouse square. This year in the state dining room, he called a private speech of his opponent. If a man is not married by the time he is 51, we ask questions in my country. Of young Winston Churchill, who is running for Parliament, you know, he lost. I would say that he has somewhat more, he meant an ability, than his father, and a great deal less than his grandfather. At one point, he looked across at his wife and raised his glass, and a very nice look passed between them, and he turned to me and said, when she was working for $5 a week as a stenotypist, and I was doing, but I forget what he said he was doing, we never thought we would someday be dining in the White House. He was very interested in the house itself and asked a lot of questions about the rooms. And then of the singing strings, he said, I would fly across the Atlantic just to hear them. Whenever plans are being made to come over, the date is set, then I start looking forward to this part of the dinner. He spoke of Lyndon as Lyndon, and he called me Ladybird. The only other chief of state that I know of who has done it yet was Prime Minister Holt. He warned me that his toast was going to be quite long and quite serious, and that Bill Fulbright wouldn't like it. And on the other side, the conversation was interesting. I was discussing the foot tracks of Great Britain that I had seen in our travels, in New Zealand and Australia and Malaysia, many places. And Sir Patrick said, on the whole, it would have perhaps been better for the world if we could have stayed around a while longer. I spoke of some of the good things England had left behind in starting a civil service, common language. In his answer, he said, there is no gratitude in international affairs. I find it impressive and admirable, the way the Britishers I know look with a cool clarity, lack of bitterness, a sort of detachment at the breakup of the British Empire. Lyndon's toast was long, too. Too long, I thought, but it was a beautiful toast. I liked the lines, the American and British peoples are not short-distance crusaders. We are veteran campaigners, not amateurs and never quitters. He said we have enormous confidence in the character of the American people and their ability to understand and master trial. There was just one light moment in speaking of the entertainment, referring to the ridiculous flap over the choice of songs. He said, we might have compromised and sung a duet. Mm-hmm. You sing God Save the Queen, and I'll sing God Bless America. Harold Wilson's toast also was long and grave. He backed Lyndon's San Antonio formula, spoke of how in Moscow last month he'd explained it to the Russian leaders, promised that once there's a move toward peace, the British will play their full part, both in negotiations and reconstruction in Vietnam, told Lyndon that his restraint in handling the Pueblo incident will earn tribute from reasoning men everywhere and indeed from history. He's an excellent public speaker, I think.
Oh,
although he insists on calling this a private speech. It was a rather late hour when we left the dinner table and went for liqueurs and coffee into the red room. There, dear Dean made his excuses and departed quietly. I understand this completely, for the long history of the Lyndon Johnsons in doing the same during the Eisenhower years. In a snatch of conversation with Mrs. Wilson, he was speaking of campaigning in their country, and said that one time they were in a car that was being rocked by angry students who were also beating on the windows and the side of the car with sticks, and that she was actually afraid. Well, we've had most everything in this country, but not quite that yet. Then we went into the East Room, and with a very few words, I introduced Bob Merrill, Veronica Tyler. I'd had a delightful moment when Bob Merrill had come down the receiving line, and we had laughed simultaneously. I had said, "You and I have a penchant for crises." His great, thrilling voice filled the room with the Gershwin songs and the Road to Mandalay, which everybody who'd ever heard of Kipling remembered and loved. And then Veronica Tyler sang some songs from Puccini and Schubert and Menotti. And then a duet, Rodgers and Hammerstein's "You'll Never Walk Alone." I thought Bess had showed great good taste in her selection of entertainment against the background of today's tensions and gravities. And Bob Merrill, as always, was so obliging. The four of us went on the stage when it was over, and there were pictures. And then Lyndon summoned up Hubert and Muriel. He always does this. And then we took the Prime Minister out in the hall. Champagne was passed. A little brief conversation. Mm-hmm. And I said goodnight at the door as Lyndon took them out to the car. He went up quickly, saying to the few around him, "I've got to get back to Keysan." And I followed by 12:15. The Joe Kilgores joined me, Jane looking like a little girl in a headband, so content and happy living back in Austin, Joe having a wonderful law practice and serving as a regent on the university board, and the children growing up in that dear town. No backward glances to Congress for them. And the Johnny Lyles, whom I discovered, actually our neighbors not 12 miles away in the hill country, the home over toward Blanco, where they spend some time each summer and a good many weekends. John, too, cast not a single backward glance toward those years in Congress. And Dell and Sherman Birdwell, who enjoyed the evening more, I think, than nearly anybody, we'd sent them all up guest lists, and I'd done some rearranging of their seating so that they would be by people I thought they would be impressed with and find companionable. We had a pleasant hour of talking Texas and old time, and inevitably John Connolly. And Joe Kilgore put an end to it a little past one when he rose and said goodnight.